What say we start today with a little pop quiz from the Bible? Can you name the first man that God created? Can you name the guy whose dad gave him an awesome Technicolor dream coat? Joseph. Can you name the man who met God in the on-fire bush that didn't burn up? Moses. Can you name the singing shepherd who knocked down Goliath with his slingshot? David. He was a rock star. You're doing well. Let's keep going. The preacher who was swallowed by a giant fish. Proving that you can't keep a good man down. The politician who was thrown to the lions. The carpenter who married the Messiah's mother. Joseph again. Different Joseph. Couple more. Can you name the man who found the treasure in the field and sold it all that he had so that he could buy the field? How about the name of the Samaritan who stopped to help the man who had been beaten up pass by the other guys? His name was not the Good Samaritan. Could you give me the name of the prodigal son, or his brother, or his father? No, you cannot. You can't give me those last guys' names because they are in parables. Stories that Jesus made up to make a point. Parables are stories of things that could happen, but they're just stories. They're made up stories, so there are no names in them. Okay, one more on the pop quiz. Luke 16. Jesus talks about a rich man who had a poor man begging on his street, all the time begging. Both the rich man and the poor man died. Do you remember this story? And we don't know the name of the rich man, but do you remember the beggar's name? Lazarus. Okay, common name back then, Lazarus. Jesus had a rich friend named Lazarus, brother of Mary and Martha. But in the story that Jesus tells today, the poor beggar's name was also Lazarus. And the reason that matters is because in all parables, Jesus never names names, ever. He doesn't use names. But in the story he tells in Luke 16, he mentions Lazarus by name. Just like the other people whose names you knew from the Old Testament stories. Real people, real names. Marking the story we're about to read as real. His name was Lazarus. This really happened, and that really matters. So here goes a true story from Jesus, based on a true story. Luke 16, 19 says, there was a rich man who was dressed in purple and fine linen. He lived in luxury every day. At his gate was laid a beggar named Lazarus, covered with sores, and longing to eat what fell from the rich man's table. Even dogs came and licked his sores. So I've introduced a lot of people in my life, but I have never introduced anyone by wardrobe and diet. This is my friend Roberto. He likes chicken and rice and very nice suits. This is my friend Eric. He likes OSU hoodies and hates onions. You don't introduce people like that. But that's what Jesus does. He says, here is a rich man, internationally attired. Purple dye is not found in Palestine. You have to import that. His suits were imported. He was living in luxury daily. He ate well. Have you ever gone on a cruise? The King James Version says, this man fared sumptuously. One commentator said this guy's whole life was just one big celebration. He was not a dishonest man. He was not a violent man. He was just a selfish man. He lived in a mansion. Most people had doors on their homes. He had doors and a long driveway and fences and gates. And at his gate regularly, was a poor man named Lazarus. His life was not a celebration. Lazarus was starving. We know that because he would often rummage through the rich guy's garbage cans looking for something edible. Lazarus was not well-dressed. In fact, his clothes were raggedy, ripped, insufficient. We know that because dogs licked Lazarus's open sores. He didn't even have enough clothing to cover his sick parts. He was weak. He could not walk. He had no strength. He was placed at the gate. He was put there by a friend, Lazarus's only friend, who must have been poor too because he couldn't offer Lazarus food, just transport. We don't know how old these two guys are, the Lazarus and rich guy, but we do know that they knew each other. And the rich guy never drove Lazarus away. He let him lay there. He never invited him in for a meal. He just ignored him. He acted like Lazarus wasn't there. He would step over him when he left the house. When he was coming home, re-entering his gate, he would ignore him. He was not deliberately mean to Lazarus. He just didn't care. Not my problem. Heading to hospital, heading up on 490, get off at Goodman Street, top of the ramp. There's a man leaning against the pillar there with a sign that says, "Anything helps." It's a red light. I'm in the second car in the turn lane. I'm even with the guy. I look at him. The guy looks at me. We're looking at each other. I'm sitting there in my car thinking, huh, wonder if his name is Lazarus. But then the light turned green. I turned left and drove away. I don't know which side you're going to see yourself in this story of Jesus's. Most of us don't identify with Lazarus, but we don't think we're the rich guy either. Rich and poor are very relative terms, though. Leroy Lawson and Bob Walther visited Eastern Europe. Their churches sent them over to try to relieve some of the poverty that was being experienced there. People there were waiting in long lines to buy shoes for their kids, to buy pieces of fabric, to make clothes, to buy a small bit of food. Often they would wait in vain. By the time they got to the front of the line, meager supplies of the stuff that was there, they were gone. It was poor. Leroy Lawson said his friend Bob tried to give an elderly Polish preacher a ballpoint pen as a gift from the United States. And the old preacher refused the pen. He said, "Oh, I have." Since he already had a ballpoint pen, he could not in good conscience accept another, because too many people in his country had no pen. He would not collect what others did not have. "I have so many pens at home, I have to use Linda's Tupperware containers to hold them all." Just saying, you might want to reconsider which role you're playing in Jesus' story, which side you're closer to. In Jesus' day, there were no hospitals, there were no nursing homes, there was no place for the ill, the lame, the blind. It was a bad time and a bad place to be poor or to be sick, and Lazarus was both. And Jesus says he died. No wonder, slowly starving, his disease untreated, lying out in the heat day after day, Lazarus died. And there is no burial mentioned. Did anyone even notice that he had died? Maybe his friend who was carrying him every day, but his friend was probably relieved and thought, Lazarus is better off dead. But then Jesus tells the story. He adds the fact that the rich man died too, because all the wealth in the world can't prevent that. The stats on death are pretty solid. One out of every one person dies, even if you're rich. The rich man died and was buried. Jesus mentioned he was buried. Probably an elaborate funeral, probably oak casket, probably black hearse, probably nice headstone. Probably lots of people showed up for the funeral. Business associates, golfing buddies, family waiting for the will to be read. But we know one person who did not show up for the funeral. That would be the rich guy. The Bible says when you die, you leave your body and you go and keep an appointment with the God who created you. The rich guy did not go to his own funeral. He was elsewhere. Jesus explains with these verses. In verse 22, he said, "The time came when the beggar died, and the angels carried him to Abraham's side. The rich man also died and was buried. In Hades, where he was in torment, he looked up and he saw Abraham far away with Lazarus by his side." He died and was buried, Jesus said, and when he looked up, the rich man closed his eyes in death and opened them up in a different world, another world. He opens his eyes, and just like that, he's in the next place. No break in the action, no commercial timeout. It was an immediate transition. And Jesus describes these next events that happen as calmly and clearly as you could tell me what you did yesterday. He said, when Lazarus died and he opened up his eyes, wonderful, beautiful, strong angels of God carried him to Abraham's side, which is a Jewish name for heaven. God promised Abraham a long time ago that one day one of his great-great-great-great-great-great-grandchildren would open up a way to heaven. And when Lazarus died, angels flew him there. We have friends who are going to soon board a plane and be flown to Hawaii. Very similar experiences. Do you remember the song, "Some glad morning when this life is o'er, I'll fly away to my home on God's celestial shore. I'll fly away when I die. Hallelujah, by and by, I will fly away." Jesus says that happened to Lazarus, and angels were in charge of his flight. So when we get to heaven, will St. Peter greet us at the gates like we've always joked? I don't know. But maybe actually Abraham will, because angels delivered Lazarus to Abraham's side, where he was welcomed, embraced. Lazarus was safe and good. But the rich guy had an immediately different experience. He passed into a very different place. He went through hell's processing center, apparently. Jesus says he was in torment. The word means extreme pain, physical or mental, incredibly bad. He had just arrived at this place, and he was already beyond what he could bear. He was in torment. Do you suppose anybody at the funeral, the rich guy's funeral, do you suppose anybody said, well, at least he's in a better place? Jesus said he wasn't. In fact, it was way worse. He was in agony and trapped. And he looked, and at a great distance, he could see where Abraham was, and he saw Lazarus there with him. He recognized Lazarus. When you die, you will still know what you know. You will still know who you know. He recognized Lazarus. And the rich guy still knew who he was. And when he spotted Lazarus with Abraham, he had a couple of thoughts. In verse 24, the rich guy called to Abraham, said, "Father Abraham, have pity on me, and send Lazarus to dip the tip of his finger in water and cool my tongue, because I am in agony in this fire." But Abraham replied, "Son, remember that in your lifetime you received your good things, while Lazarus received bad things? But now he is comforted here, and you're in agony. And besides all this, between us and you, a great chasm has been set in place, so that those who want to go from here to you can't, nor can anyone cross over from there to us." The rich guy is going to make two desperate requests here, but shockingly, one of them is not to get out. He doesn't ask to be saved. Apparently, that's a non-starter. The rich guy's request number one was, "Make Lazarus come over here and serve me. Make him put a drop of water on my tongue. Just a drop would really help. And he can use his diseased fingers. I don't care. I just need some relief. Send him over here with a drop of water." Abraham responded, "Request denied." He said, "Do you remember back on earth you had water and food and everything, remember? And you had good stuff and could not be bothered to give any of it to Lazarus when he needed?" I bet the rich guy remembered. I bet he remembered everything. He was haunted by what he remembered. All those chances he had to do good in his life, to be kind, to help people, to help Lazarus, he remembered. But the deal is, anybody who does not help here will find no help there. And yet, in spite of all that, I'm guessing Abraham and Lazarus still probably would have brought water for the rich guy. Except there's a wide, impassable chasm between heaven and hell, and nobody crosses it ever. Think Grand Canyon. Can't get from this side to that side. And it was put there to prevent passage. Abraham's negative response must have been devastating to this guy. Nobody had ever said no to him before in life. No water? No one's coming? Never? Desperate, the rich guy makes a second request. In fact, he begs Abraham for this next one. The rich guy has now become the beggar. Did you see that? The first become last, you know, and the last become first. In verse 27, the rich guy says, "Then I beg you, Father, send Lazarus to my family, for I have five brothers. Let him warn them so that they won't also come to this place of torment." Abraham replied, "They have Moses and the prophets. Let them listen to them." "No, Father Abraham," he said, "but if somebody from the dead goes to them, they'll repent." And Abraham said, "If they do not listen to Moses and the prophets, they will not be convinced even if someone rises from the dead." So he doesn't ask Abraham to let him go back to get out. The rich guy knows he's never going to get out. He's there to stay. But he wants Abraham to order Lazarus to go back into life and warn his five brothers to live differently so that they don't end up like him. And Abraham responds, "Request denied." Abraham says, "They have God's word. They have the Bible. They know. They have true written communication from God about how we should live life. But the rich guy's thinking, that's not enough. They need more. My brothers need more. They need a resurrection miracle to wake them up. And he's asking for his brothers, but kind of his underlying point is that God didn't give them or him adequate warning. But Abraham says, where you ended up isn't due to an inadequate Bible. The problem is your inadequate obedience. You didn't listen to what God had said. It sounds like the rich guy is trying to help out his brothers at first, but what he's really doing underneath is cursing God. The rich guy saying God could have prevented all this if he wanted to, if he'd made it more clear. The rich guy saying God should have tried harder. It's his fault that I'm here. That's that they're heading here. That's God's fault. Do you see that? He's in hell and there's still no remorse in his heart. He thinks God's been unfair to him. He's in hell and he still thinks he's smarter than God, more advanced than God, better than God. So, would his brothers believe what God says if somebody came back from the dead? No. This guy is dead, and he doesn't believe what God says. And that's the end of the story. That's the end of Jesus' story. What do you think? One of your favorites? I think that story is probably one of the most important stories you could ever teach your kids, ever. Because, first of all, it deals with the reality of life after death. Jesus says two guys died, and after that, both of them went on with their lives. Did you see that? They died, and then they went on with their lives. Some people say when you die, then you're done. That's it, nothingness. Those people often live however they want to live because they think when they die, it's over. Nothing exists except what's here now. There's nothing coming, nothing else, so nothing matters to them. There are other people who say that once you die, you get kind of recycled. You get recirculated, repurposed. You will be made alive again. You'll be reincarnated into something different than what you were before. A husband told his wife he was reading about reincarnation, and it was pretty interesting to him. He said he wondered if, when he died, if he might come back like as a slug or something. And she said, oh, no, you can never be the same thing twice. Nothing. After we're done, is there nothing? Do we turn into something else after we're done here? Do we end up in heaven or hell after we're done here? What happens next? How can you even know? Fred Parks tells a story about Quill, who was a guy in the Kentucky mountains who was always hunting and fishing illegally. He was famous for hunting and fishing illegally, which infuriated the game warden because he could never quite catch Quill in the act. So one night, the game warden decided he was going to sneak out, he was going to spy on Quill, he was going to stay by his cabin in the woods, he's going to camp on a nearby hillside, only about 20, 30 yards away from the cabin, figuring that when Quill woke up the next morning and went out, he would follow him and then arrest him for hunting and fishing illegally. The game warden stayed out there all night, nearly froze to death, terrible night. Early the next morning, he heard Quill start to move around inside the cabin. He began to smell fresh brewing coffee coming out, biscuits baking. He heard bacon sizzling, and his stomach started growling. And right then, Quill came out on his front porch, and he looked up the hill and he yelled, "You might as well come in. I know you're out there. Come on down. You can have breakfast with me." Well, the game warden could not believe it. He'd been so careful not to be seen. And as he came down the hill, he was trying to figure out what had given him away. Had he made too much noise during the night? Had Quill spotted him behind the tree? How did he know? And he went inside and he sat down at the table and he started to eat breakfast. And the game warden said, "Quill, how in the world did you know I was out there?" And Quill said, Oh, I didn't know you were out there. I just say that every morning in case you are." Some people look at church participation kind of like that. Don't really know if there's anything to it. Don't really think there's anything to it, but I just want to keep all my bases covered, you know, if it's for real. But in this story, Jesus pulls back the curtain between life and death, and he shows us what really happens next. Two guys died, and after that, they both went on with their lives. And your kids, your friends need to know that dying changes things, but it does not end them. And that's the truth. And if you're not figuring that into how you live, then you're not living right. This story deals with reality. Second, it deals with finality. In dealing with stuff like the origins of the universe or the where people came from or the existence of angels, Jesus always just said, this is how it is. I know and I'm telling you the truth. When it comes to stuff like life after death, the existence of heaven and hell, eternal judgment, Jesus always says, this is how it is. I know and I'm telling you the truth. Jesus says, two guys died. After that, one of them went to heaven and one of them went to hell. And Jesus is not trying to scare anybody into doing anything. He's just telling us what is real, which makes this story real scary. Because Jesus says that all of that happened for real 2,000 years ago, and both guys are still there. And Jesus said they knew instantly where they were. The guy in hell, he never asked to get out. He never asked to be let out. He never pleaded for a pardon. He knows he's where he is because of what he chose in life, and that window is closed. I saw a poster on a wall once that said, when one door closes, another always opens. And underneath that, someone had written, other than that, it's a really good car. But it turns out that when it comes to death, when one door closes, that's where you stay. So you won't have to wonder if you made it or not. When you open up your eyes in the next life, what you see is where you'll be. Seems really important to wake up good, right? Because it's real and it's final. The third thing that this story emphasizes, reality, finality, and non-neutrality. Non-neutrality. You're either with Jesus or you lose. So you really ought to go with Jesus. And almost everybody wants you to. Almost everybody in the universe wants you to be on Jesus' side. I've heard that there are three kinds of people in the world. There are those who are good with numbers and those who are not. But in truth, there are really only four kinds of people in the universe. There are people who are alive and following Jesus. And there are people who are dead and following Jesus. And there are people who are alive and not following Jesus, and there are people who are dead and not following Jesus. There are really only four. When it all comes down to it, those are the four types of people in the universe. And three of them want you to follow Jesus. Obviously, those of us who are alive and following Jesus, we want everybody to join in and follow him too. And those who follow Jesus who have already died, they are experiencing greatness, and they want that for you too. But what if you have family and friends who don't follow Jesus, who did not follow Jesus while they were alive? What do they want for you right now regarding Jesus? People who did not follow Jesus and are dead. I was sitting with a missionary family in Panama once, the husband and wife and their 20-something daughter and their high school son. And we were talking about how many Panamanians hesitate to follow Jesus because they have family members who have died without accepting Jesus' offer. And the Panamanians who are alive don't want to get good with God through Jesus because in their minds that means the people they love who didn't get good with Jesus aren't. Do you see the problem? If they ask Jesus in baptism to cover their sins and make them good with God, then they're kind of indicting their grandmother who never asked Jesus for forgiveness. Or they're kind of saying that their father who wasn't a Christian is in trouble. Or they're kind of saying their sister who never cared about Jesus and died is in hell. And the Panamanians were troubled by all that. And they didn't want to really get in themselves because that would mean something about somebody who died. If I agree that Jesus is the only way in, I'm kind of condemning people I love who didn't do that. Kind of condemning them to hell. So I'm not sure I want to do that. That's how the Panamanians were thinking. And I heard that story and I thought, wow, that's kind of a legitimate concern. How do you get past that? I've seen people here who don't want to get in because somebody they love died without getting in. They said it happens a lot in Panama. So we were talking about that, and the daughter of the missionary couple said, well, do you remember the story of the rich guy and Lazarus? And I said, yeah. She said, the rich guy, he was in hell. I said, yeah. And she said, he only wanted two things. He wanted some water, and he did not want his brothers to end up where he was. She said, if we have people we love in hell right now, the only thing they want for us, the thing they want for us most, is for us to get right with Jesus and go to heaven. More than anything else, they want us to follow Jesus. So we help the Panamanians understand that our friends and family in heaven want us to join them, and our friends and family in hell want us not to join them. And everybody should get in and opt for heaven with Jesus. In fact, the only group of the four groups that doesn't want you to follow Jesus is the group of people who are alive right now but not following Jesus, and their opinion about that's all going to change as soon as they die and discover reality and finality. What happens when we die? We are either good or we are not good, and it all comes to who you choose to listen to. Jesus pulls back the curtain of eternity to let us see what's next in Luke chapter 16. Reality, finality, non-neutrality. I got one more. Liberality. Liberality. It's all, this story is about being generous. The rich guy did not go to hell because he was rich. Abraham was very rich, and he was in heaven welcoming Lazarus there. Being rich or not being rich is not the issue. The rich guy went to hell because he didn't think God's way was the best way to use his money. All that doing unto others as you wish they would do to you, all that caring for orphans and widows, all that storing up treasure in heaven, no. He used his money for whatever he wanted to use his money for. And the idea of helping Lazarus out there at the end of the driveway, that did not even occur to him. And Jesus tells this story at the end of a bunch of teachings about being generous, about how his people, people who follow him, will be generous. To help us know that not to help when we can help is wrong. This is a cautionary tale for rich people, this story of Jesus. And folks, rich people be us. No, really, you are way wealthier than you think you are. U.S. News and World Report featured a test which allows people to see whether they're rich or whether they're poor. And being curious, when I heard that, I took the test. It's not hard, there are only four questions, and you can answer each yes or no. Interested? Sure, let's take the test. And then we'll always know which side of the line we're on, rich or poor. Keep track of your answers as we go, and you will determine, compared to the world, if you are rich or poor. Question number one, you ready? Do you have more than one pair of shoes? Question number two, do you have a choice of what you will eat today? Question number three, do you have your own transportation of any kind? Question number four, do you have any underwear besides what you're wearing right now? And if you said yes to any three of those questions, then like me, you are very rich. In fact, less than 10% of people who have ever lived throughout all of history have all four luxuries. So if you have all four, you are in the upper 10% of all the people who have ever lived. For me, I counted 8 pairs of shoes just sitting there thinking about them, and I forgot to count the ones I was wearing. One third of all the people in our world today never dream about owning a pair of shoes. For me, I eat 2 to 3 meals a day, I often have seconds, and I am constantly snacking. Millions of people around the world today will be thankful for one meal, and it will be the same as what they ate yesterday for their one meal, and they will have it again tomorrow for their one meal, which being interpreted means they have no choice in what they eat, which being interpreted means they're not eating what they want. For me, in terms of transportation, I have owned 1, 2, 3, or 4 cars at a time for the past 40 years. But half of the world walks everywhere they go, never expecting to own a car, a bike, a horse, a donkey, or rollerblades of their own. Most of them don't get shoes. And as to the last question, I choose to make no public comment about my underwear. But I will admit, based on that test, compared to most people in the world, I am so very rich. And Jesus' story shows that being rich carries responsibility. If my possessions cause me to ignore or neglect people that I could help, I'm in trouble, just like the rich guy in Jesus' story. I had to go back to the hospital the next day. I'm driving up 490. I'm wondering if the guy's still going to be at the Goodman Street exit. Right there, standing right there, holding the same card. I had to go visit someone else in the hospital later that week. I wondered if the guy would still be there. He wasn't. There was a lady standing there, holding a sign saying, "Anything helps." We always have a chance. When it comes to using our stuff, God says, "I will entrust you with this much. Use it wisely. Help people liberally. And I will check in with you about all that later." Luke 16, best story in the whole Bible? Maybe. The one story from Jesus that covers the most? Maybe. Jesus' cliff notes on reality, finality, non-neutrality, and liberality? Yep. And I found a new website this week. It lets you type in any prefix or suffix, and then it lists all the words that begin or end with the letters that you typed in. This is a preacher's delight. I could not spend enough time on this website because it helps me come up with closing lines to sermons like this one. The universality of spirituality is not an abnormality, but rather demonstrates a commonality superseding nationality, personality, or locality. And since Jesus says our immortality is a sure eventuality, then there's a certain rationality to enhancing the centrality of our functionality, intentionality, frugality, hospitality, and punctuality, while working hard at decreasing our sensuality, brutality, and criminality. Or said another way, there is a heaven, and there is a hell, and there is a hurry. Let's pray with me.